everyone, and welcome to For Azeroth, the show all about World of Warcraft. I'm your host, Jocelyn, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Manny. Manny, how's it going?
Doing really well this week. Much better now that the snow's gone.
Good. I almost said, Manny, how's it going, man? And then I was like, that sounds really weird. Yeah, we are slowly coming out of our ice storm. Kind of everything's melting and it's starting to feel a little bit more like spring, and it's almost May, so it's about freaking time. I will agree with you on that one. It's been an absolutely crazy week, and I can't even believe how much stuff we have to cover today, considering like we are recording this on a Friday. We recorded our previous episode on a Monday, so like there's only been 4 days of potential WoW news between episodes, but somehow we have a whole lot to talk about today. So that's starting with we thought we were going to get a week without an update to the alpha, but nope, we got a new alpha patch. So this is patch 26476 on the alpha build, and we now have some new allied races available, right?
Oh yes. So in the latest build, they've now unleashed Dark Iron Dwarves and the Maghar Orcs onto the player base, so you can create those on the alpha. They have put so much love into these characters. It's weird though, because the animations actually don't differ from the normal orcs or the normal dwarves, but the little flourishes that they've put in have really shown some love. So you've got the totems that have their own little animations, like the Dark Iron Dwarves actually have an animation where they drill in for a little bit.
Oh,
before
fun.
Before they're fully active, yeah. And there is the awesome Dark Iron Dwarf Paladin Mount, which just is seething metal. The Dark Iron Dwarves are just metal. That's what they
are. Right, yeah. They're very, like, deep earth mining drills. Like, anytime I think of the Dark Iron Dwarves, I think of, and I'm totally blanking on which instance it is, but it's in the mountain, the Blackrock Mountain.
Blackrock Depths is more orcs, but Molten Core. Nope, that's elementals.
The raid, yeah. But there's like you use the like drill thing that comes out of the ground as a way to get around the instance. So like that's what I think of when I think of Dark Iron Dwarves, is those drill things, because they also pop out of the ground in Ulduar when you're fighting that. Damn, I'm totally blanking on the Frost Dragon. Anyways, you're fighting a big dragon, and then all the little Dark Iron Dwarves pop out of the ground in their little drill hut things. So I love that they're pulling through all of that flavor into things like the Shaman Totems and the Paladin Mounts. That's really, really cool. So when you go into the alpha to create these characters, do you have to go through some big unlock kind of procedure to get there? Or because like when I created my character on the alpha accidentally, I literally was going in to do something on live and then didn't realize I had alpha selected, and then got to the character creation screen and I was like, is live broken? What's going on? Where's all my characters? And so I just made a character, got in, and I was like, oh, alpha, way to go, Joss, have another coffee. But I didn't see options for like Nightborn and everything else. So
okay, so it's much the same as how you would create the other allied races. When you go to the original character screen, there's the option for allied races, and then below that you'll see the new ones added. The scenarios for unlocking them to your faction and the scenario for them actually being created before you go to whatever level they start, we're assuming level 20 like the rest of them, that's not in just yet. There is broadcast text for the Dark Irons, right? And there has been information about the Maghar Orcs from previous patch, but they're not active right now. So when you create these, they're the 110 templates that you can play with all the other characters going into Zandalar and Kil'Teris.
So is there actually a Dark... Because I know there's a... Is it Maghar Orcs? Is that how you say it? Okay.
Yep.
I know that there is a faction of them in Outland, which I'm assuming you'll have to like complete the storylines that have to do with them, and or get your reputation up to Exalted, which Mine already is because they had a whole bunch of mounts. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to farm these stupid obsidian war beads and turn them all in and get these like 6 or 7 mounts from them. So I assume that you're going to have to be exalted with them and possibly complete their Outland storyline in order to bring them into the Horde.
But well, that's the thing, though.
Oh,
they're not the Outland version. They're the Draenor version. So I hope you haven't been grinding the wrong faction.
I did it for the mounts. So I did it for the mounts. But still, yeah. Damn, I don't want to do Draenor things.
That being said, these are looking to be unlocked behind the Warfront campaign, which you don't even start till we're into Zandalar and Kel'Thuris, right? That starts right now on the Alpha at level 112 and seems to continue through to endgame at 120. So you're going to be going through that, leveling your first character, and then once you've completed the war campaign at max level, then you'll unlock these two new races to play and start up.
Mm. That's interesting because, like, they are, like, I mean, from, I thought they were the Outland ones, but even if they're the Draenor ones, it's interesting that you're, like, they're already going to be involved with the Warfronts. Like, I don't know. I just, the way that they've explained allied races in the past has been, like, you have to kind of solve whatever their problem is and bring them into the Horde. But if they're already involved with Warfronts, they've already chosen a side, so... That just seems a little bit off to me. But, I mean, I'm sure it's all going to be explained in-game. And you mentioned when Warfronts were unlocking. So Warfronts look like they unlock at 112, or that's currently where they unlock in the Alpha. The other thing I saw this week, which I don't know if we knew before, but there were some changes with Island Expeditions, right, with this Alpha build. And so it looks like Island Expeditions unlock at 115, unless you're doing the Heroic, Mythic, or PvP versions, which I found really interesting because I didn't realize, like, I knew there was going to be PvE and PvP. I didn't realize there were actually going to be, like, difficulty tiers to these islands. So I am even more excited about the Island Expeditions than I was before. I guess there's 3 available to play on the Alpha right now, and I can't wait to actually get in there and try. Like, I know I have to level up my character and actually get to 120, but man, I want to try that PvP version of the Island Expeditions so bad.
Well, yeah, like what they're doing is that they are staging the different difficulties throughout. The war campaign is actually a story campaign that you have to go through to then get to the story point where you are saying, okay, we need to bring in the Magcar Orcs and we need to bring in the Dark Iron Dwarves. So they're already connecting that to some story event that will happen later. The Island Expeditions, yeah, you can do normal versions starting at 115 as of this latest patch, and then, of course, the heroic versions at the end game and the PvP and so forth. What we are also seeing is that they are being nice about this from the get-go, and it's account-bound unlock, so once you've unlocked on your main, you don't have to freak out on your alts to go through a process of unlocking them. They're nice. Very much learning their lessons from Legion.
Good. I mean, I'm sure that it'll still be applied to levels, so, like, if I unlock it on my 120 main, I can't then go and, you know, grab my 110 brand spanking new mage and throw her into an Island Expedition. She'll still have to get up to 115 or 112 as far as the war fronts are concerned. So, like, they're still probably going to have those levels tied to them, but you won't have to go through all of the rep grinding and everything else. Like, oh man, Suramar. I'm just shaking my head right now. Like, just saw Suramar. That was so bad. So alt unfriendly, but I'm glad that they, like you said, learned their lessons and seem like they're going to be giving us many more ways to actually level our alts. And hopefully that's going to go through to professions as well. I know that they've made a lot of changes to professions, but I just, like, I want this to feel a little more alt friendly than Legion did. I felt like every time I switched characters, I was being super punished. So we also had 4 new dungeons open up. So, man, there's some really interesting stuff in here. We talked last week about the Kul'Tirans and the 4 different houses that form the council that govern them. And Waycrest is one of them. So there's actually Waycrest Manor is one of the new dungeons that's opened up. And So this is going to be the whole confrontation about her being a little bit evil and trying to kind of overthrow the council and oust the Proudmoors. I'm really interested after our talk last week to see how this particular dungeon plays out from a lore perspective.
Oh, yeah. And what you're seeing is that they're having the story in its own and in these dungeons. So this is going to be the like climax of the story, which has been making some very interesting dungeons. The same with the Underrot. As you go through Nazmir and all the stuff with the blood trolls, the Underrot is the final chapter of that, right?
I think I like this kind of style of storytelling because they did a similar thing with, although it ended in both a dungeon and a raid, but with the whole Emerald Nightmare thing in, oh my God, why am I blanking on this zone name? I'm thinking like the Dream Grove, but that's the dirt. Yes, thank you, Valshara. It was very, very similar where you went through the whole zone, unlocked a whole bunch of different quest hubs, we're helping Tyrande, and then Malfurion gets captured, and then like you have to go and do Darkheart Thicket in order to kind of free him, and then you had to go and do the whole Fears of Alun temple thing. Like it was, I really liked the way they ended that. In the past, I've been, because I was a more casual player when I first started playing, because I was so far behind everybody else, I really didn't like locking content behind, in particular, raiding, because I didn't have a raid team, so there was a lot of story I didn't get to see. And I feel like this is a really good kind of in-between. It's like the whole entire story of a zone isn't told just in questing. They kind of finish it off with more accessible content that's easier for people to jump into. I find it's easier to jump into when you're a newer player, a small group of five, while you still get the feeling of, you know, doing important things and defeating bosses and doing something together. And I know that LFR is a thing, but when you're a new player and you're not as familiar with the game, jumping into LFR, it's a daunting task, you know, like the idea of jumping in with like 25 strangers to do something you've never done before that you have no training in. Often like the barrier between or the jump from questing to raiding is huge when you've never done things with people in the game before. So I didn't like when they took the whole story and put it behind a raid, but they seem to be kind of finding this really cool balance between the questing and the raiding. And because a lot more people are getting funneled through this questing into dungeons into raid sort of content path, I feel like the jump is smaller and new players might be more willing to go through the questing and then be like, oh, okay, yeah, I can play with five people. And then like, oh, okay, it's like five groups of five people now. And, you know, making that leap into LFR might be a little bit easier for them. So I love that they're doing this.
Oh, yeah. And like dungeons have always been like core part of World of Warcraft. I feel like what they've done in Legion is really made dungeons like unique and very much like accessible. They are really doubling down on that with the design that they've done with dungeons, where they have these kind of epic moments and trash that sort of interacts with each other, where if you pull this trash, it'll slow your movement. And if you pull this trash, it creates void zones. If you pull them together, well, that's just a recipe for disaster. So right. Like mechanically, dungeons have actually become a lot better at being a stepping stone to raid mechanics. So it's definitely there.
Yeah, so I really like that progression. So we mentioned Waycrest Manor and the Underrot, but there's two other ones that opened up as well. So Shrine of the Storm, where does that one come in? That sounds a little bit like, again, Kul Tiran side, Alliance side, just because we talked last week about the Kul Tirans and how they have their, not Tide Callers, but they're like their ocean priestesses or ocean priests. I can't remember what exactly they were called, but... that seems like a Kul Tiran thing to me.
Yeah, I'd say. They just... we'll have to remember sometime.
Yeah.
some angry email is coming in shortly.
But yeah, yes, we literally just talked about it. Why is my memory so bad?
But that's going to be in Stormsong, right? And then the Temple of Thrathalus is going to be in Vol'Dun, and that's going to end the story there. So that's added to the Motherlode, and the cannot remember the dungeon for Zaldalar.
Oh, it's the one where Baron Samdi is like a big quest hub giver thing, isn't it? Yeah, I'm blanking too. But yeah, so there's what? So four new dungeons, so six dungeons total available on the alpha. So it's really cool, everything that they're doing with dungeons, and I can't wait to see more of it. We also got some racial changes, and this is more around CC, I guess. So, man.
Yep, the two big racial changes were every man for himself, which is constantly caused issues in PvP. It was the human racial that they put in.
I know. Oh,
yeah. And so for those who don't know what it is, it was a 2-minute cooldown, and it allowed them to escape from basically everything.
Which was super frustrating when I was, because this, obviously I was PvPing the most in Warlords of Draenor because there was nothing else to do. But when I was farming Ashran and trying to get all of my titles so that I could be Warlord, so you had to kill 500 of each enemy race. And it was so frustrating because you'd go in as Horde, and Horde had a fairly diverse, like there were some races that were harder to find than others. But for the most part, the makeup of the Horde races was pretty diverse. And then you'd go against these teams of like 40 Alliance that were all freaking humans. And I was like, no, I need to kill Worgen. Where are the Worgen? And it was just nobody was playing them because anyone who was PvPing, the human racial was just so overpowered that they were like, why would I ever be anything else? I can literally add, because like CC is so important in PvP. So giving anyone one extra tool to get out of that, especially on such a short cooldown, was just ridiculously overpowered. So everyone was humans, and it was awful.
Yeah. And originally, it didn't even share cooldown with the PvP trinket, so you would have a second escape. Then they added in what it is currently on live, where it shares a 30-second cooldown with other effects that do the same thing. Well, they've taken the nerf bat to it. It's now a 3-minute cooldown.
Excellent.
And it shares a 90-second shared cooldown with anything that does a similar ability. So
many thumbs up.
But that's not even the big one. The big one that everybody is freaking out about is Arcane Torrent, the Blood Elf racial.
I thought this was going to get hit pretty hard.
Ooh, it got hit. So basically what it used to do was that it was a 1.5-minute cooldown that did an interrupt and did a silence. Well, really, it did a silence on everybody, and
right.
It did an interrupt on non-player characters. Well, they decided it's no longer an interrupt, it's no longer a silence. Now, what it does is that it's an AoE dispel, where it removes, like, one positive buff off of all enemies within, like, 7 yards, I believe it is. So, it's a lot weaker than it used to be.
Yeah, so this dispel effect is only on opponents too, right? So it's not like you're getting rid of one harmful effect from any allies in your range and one positive effect from any enemies. It's just affecting your enemies. So it's kind of unfortunate. I mean, it always did only affect, like, it was like an offensive ability sort of thing. Like, it only affected your enemies. So that's not a big change. But if they were going to make it this bad, I would hope that they would at least like attempt to balance it a little bit more by adding the positive effect to your allies. But yeah, rip Blood Elves.
Well, it's the alpha. Maybe they will change it. I think it's in a decent place right now because it is an AoE dispel. It is like you have a Blood Elf warrior run in and he could just tear off like a bunch of bonuses from anybody that's near him, right? And
that
it's not
true.
Like it, and it's not like it shares a cooldown with people around you. So if there's a big swarm of Blood Elves, they could like tear off all the buffs from you with coordinated play. So like it does have applications. It's not the end of the world. People will get used to it. And I'm glad that Blizzard is taking the steps to say, okay, you know what? We need to bring this to a sane level. You're looking at the new racials. There are some ones in there that are pretty meh. There are some ones that are in there that are like very flavorful and I love them. But there is a new racial that the Dark Iron Dwarves got, where they will now cleanse themselves of any bleeds, poisons, diseases, magic curses on them.
Wow.
So I'm just wait a second.
That kind of makes sense from a lore perspective, but seems way too powerful.
Well, I'm not done yet, because boosts your primary stat
what?
By a base amount, and then for every single negative effect that you remove off, it gives you an additional bonus to your primary stat. So people could be laying in on you. Like, I could see a warlock just laying in on you, and you're like, thanks, buddy, and suddenly, boom, here's 1,000 agility, smash.
Yeah, wow. That seems like that's something that's probably going to get changed, I would think. And it's always funny. I mean, we talk about how it's still alpha, and a lot of these things, especially when you're talking about gear, are often placeholders, and even through to beta and PTR and stuff. There's a lot of things that get put in there that are very much placeholders. But some things you're just who thought this was a good idea? Did anyone actually talk to the balance team when they decided that every effect you remove is going to buff your primary stat? That's insane.
It is insane, and I think it's more about Blizzard's philosophy of making people seem powerful and then reining it in. Mm-hmm. What could easily be done to this is that they cap it. It's okay, you can remove all these curses and stuff, but you only get up to this amount of the primary
stacks. Yeah. That makes sense. And you're right. Blizzard, we see that across all games. It's they bring things in really powerful and then they pull them back, because that's easier to do than attempting to buff things outside of a game. Well, I guess WoW and Heroes of the Storm have the ability to kind of tweak small percentages of things, whereas Hearthstone, it's much more macro changes. So, but all games seem to bring things in a very powerful state and then pull them progressively back a little bit. So
rein them in.
Yeah, rein them in. Exactly. So I think you're right. We'll probably see some changes to the Dark Iron Dwarves, but man, that seems so powerful. What kind of a cooldown is it on? Just out of curiosity, is this something they could do once a minute, or?
No, it's a longer cooldown. I believe it's 3 minutes for that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
So super duper OP button, but at least they can only push it once every 3 minutes. So I'm interested to see how that works out. I feel like that could be a really interesting racial in Arena, because arenas are so quick that you'll probably only get to pop it once. So I feel like there could be kind of a skill cap there of waiting until you're, getting pretty low. You've got a whole bunch of debuffs on you, and then all of a sudden, ba-bam, the crazy kind of flip the board, flip the game type of an ability. So that I feel could be interesting in Arena, but I also don't want to see every single Alliance player just going Dark Iron Tour. So but that is, I'm glad they're in. I'm glad we're getting to see some of this stuff. We can also use our add-ons if they work in alpha, which is great.
Add-ons are finally available in the alpha. That means, yes, you can import your alphas in whatever state that they may work. It means that the developers of the add-ons are now going to start focusing and building towards that. I honestly think this, more than anything else in the patch, is a sign that we are moving away from the alpha and more into a beta, because all the major functions are in there now. So this is good news for moving towards our August release date.
Yeah, I mean, the sooner things go into more of a beta type form, the better it's going to be for all these add-on developers, because the more time they're going to have to work on it, right? Whenever you have big changes and big systems, and especially things like Warfronts, things like Island Expeditions, people are going to be wanting to either add functionality to existing add-ons or build totally new add-ons to deal with some of these mechanics and to kind of help people navigate all the UI and stuff and kind of min-max their experience through those things. So the sooner that this is available for developers, I think the better. So I'm interested to see what kind of new add-ons come out of the community dealing with a lot of these new things that are coming in Battle for Azeroth, We also got new models, and actually one of the new models that we received in this build dictated our lore for this week. So we are going to cover Lady Liadrin because she gets new armor in this patch, and that to me points to her potentially playing a large role in Battle for Azeroth. We've actually seen her. She was very briefly in Burning Crusade, but then she kind of, especially with Legion and the Paladin Order Hall, she kind of came back into the forefront. She was involved with Warlords of Draenor, but definitely kind of came into her own in Legion. So especially with all the stuff with the Paladins and then the Army of Light and everything else. So Liadrin has played quite a large role in this past expansion. And because she also got a model update at the beginning of Legion, I believe. So she's kind of been getting more and more done to her over time. So I'm interested to see what her... She's also a hero in Hearthstone now, which, you know, there's not a whole lot of those. And she got recognition last year. So I think, we could be seeing a lot from her. So we're going to cover her in lore today. But we got two other ones as well.
Well, the two completely new models are the old man, Grom Hellscream. Looks very much like Grom Hellscream, but he's gray. He's not quite the silver fox that I'd say like some people were expecting. He looks like he's been through a lot.
Poor Grom. Well, yeah, he died in one timeline. That, I feel like, would take a toll on you.
But you look at Seraphang, and he seems to be carrying his age well. Mm. That's a silver fox.
Oh, man. We also got some new armor sets, right, in this alpha build.
Yes, we got the mail set for the Warfronts, going through, like, levels 1, 2, and 3 for those tiers. And then we also got the cloth and plate versions of the Uldur sets. So these are the same things that we covered with the mail set from Uldur. They are the Titan-ish inspired versions. They do look really cool. Love those mythic sets. Really wish I could collect those faster. But yeah. The sets, like we explained before, are based on the type of armor it is, not based on the class, and it's based on where you get it. So the Battlefront set is very much identifying Horde version, and we haven't seen the Alliance version of that yet. And then the Uldur sets are not faction-based. They are based on where you're getting it from this Titan facility. So they do have that influence.
Very, very cool. Well, I'm looking forward to getting in there and doing some more testing now that we're getting closer and closer to what feels like beta. Speaking of testing, last Tuesday, they did the Warfront testing, the whole battle with the blues thing. Did you have a chance to get in there? Because I did Angry Chicken, so I didn't have a chance to jump into Warfront testing. But did you have a chance to jump in and see the Warfronts with the whole battle for the blues? Or battle with the blues?
Battle with the blues. So, yes, I did jump in there. It was a real strain at first. They were having issues loading people in. There was a lot of disconnects, even when we did get in. There was a lot of lag issues, which persisted very much till close to the end, where it actually got much better. That being said, it was an epic experience. Never before in WoW have I seen something on this scale. You are part of a army. You help with like these different waves of enemies coming in and your forces going out. It's very much a like attack and then counterattack and defend. The systems in there are completely new to World of Warcraft. It is very much a new way of playing. And that scares me because it's going to be behind that often scary word, time gating, because you are only going to play this when it's your turn to attack, and right, that's going to be dictated.
So you were on, like, the blues were like defending and you were attacking the Warfront, or I guess no, because it's a it's not a PvP thing. This is so hard for me to wrap my head around, like how a Warfront could not be PvP content, or at least the choice to turn it on and have people bomb both sides. But so you were the attacking team as opposed to, well, I guess there is no defending team because the defense is PV is all NPCs, right?
Yes, very much. And like that is very core to how this plays. There is the new AI that you see on the island. So the enemies don't act the same way as you've encountered before. And there's different AI for different roles. So you have like a healer and you'll be like attacking the healer. And the healer will be like, okay, you know, I'm going to back off and like heal my guys from out of line of sight. Mm. Right. They're a lot more intelligent and they will like focus on one person instead of attacking whoever is closest. They will like defend each other. Like there will be a warrior that'll come in and start slowing you so that the range guy can get some distance and start attacking you from afar. They have done a really good job with that. The way the system works overall is that it is a point capture system with each point you capture gaining you different things. So you start off and you're in your airship and you jump into your base, which is already under attack. And once you've defended your base and created your foothold, then there are two nodes that are really close to you, one for ore, one for wood. Much like in the Warcraft 3 RTS. So you capture those.
Which they did say when they were talking about Warfronts that they were going to borrow very heavily from those Warcraft RTS elements.
Yes, and it's very apparent. You feel like that hero unit in Warcraft 3. Players can like recruit different, I don't want to say mercenaries, but foot soldiers to follow alongside you and also recruit and train up and upgrade general foot soldiers that will push out into the enemy forces. Meanwhile,
those like foot soldiers that you can recruit have the same sort of advanced AI behind them, so they're using the same sort of tactics?
Exactly that. Yeah, they're acting intelligently. You will have like the archers not run in or trying to get distance. You'll have healers that will stay at range so that they can heal you without being bombarded. And what will happen is that as you're upgrading your troops and as you're recruiting your troops, right, the enemy will counterattack and take the points and upgrade their troops and upgrade their forces to eventually try and push you out. So while we were saying that it was most likely that the attacking force was not going to win, the attacking force was always going to win.
Yeah.
Right. There is the possibility that you can lose this. I'm not sure how they're going to cover that in game if we failed and so we're going to have to wait another week to like build up the resources. But there is actually like a threat from the enemy forces. And the reason that this is PvE is because the enemy forces start at a much better position than you. They own all but your base when the thing starts and you have to catch those nodes, push against those forces, and develop your base, or you will get overrun.
I am really glad that there's a chance that you can lose because they made it sound very much like if you were participating in the Warfront and you were the attacking team, you were just going to win and things were going to flip and that's the way that it was going to work. And I'm glad that there is a chance for the defending team to actually hang on to that. And I think that's really important because the defending team doesn't actually get to participate. So I think that it needs to be weighted a little bit more heavily towards the defending team because there's no player interaction on that side. So I'm glad it's not just going to be whoever gets it first. After that, it's just going to go like, if Horde get it first, then it's just Alliance, Horde from then on. And if Alliance get it first, then it's just Horde, Alliance from then on. So I'm also interested because you called it time gating, but I wouldn't think that this is as close to time gating as what we've seen in the past. It's not like time gating to me would be like, okay, every Tuesday there's a battle for the Warfront. This is much more like you can gather resources as slowly or quickly as you want. And then that's going to be what triggers the Warfront event. So this could be, and I feel like it probably will, very, very early on in the expansion. Again, assuming that holding the Warfront is something that your faction really wants to do and assuming that there's good content behind owning the Warfront, we could see this flopping every couple of days. I'm sure later on in the expansion, it might be a little bit more, week to week and then possibly a couple of weeks in either faction's control as people move away from doing war fronts. But I'm hoping that this stays relevant, and I don't really know how it could stay relevant from a lore perspective, because one way or another, the battle for Azeroth will end. Whether one faction is victorious over the other, or a greater threat from the deeps comes and we have to deal with it, one way or another, war fronts, I think, will have to stop. So I hope that this is interesting enough content that it's flipping quite often throughout the course of its lifespan, I guess, is the best way for me to put that. And that it isn't just like, oh, we play this for a week and then everybody starts, or maybe like play this for a month and then everybody starts raiding and then Warfront content is no longer, you know, important or valid.
Oh, yeah. And they have said that they do want to keep these relevant. So what I am thinking is that it, with the release of every like new tier, they'll up the difficulty. So like the opponents will have more health and more and do more damage, so that whatever the relevant raid tier will give you something about the same difficulty,
but not overpowered. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, the rewards will be competitive, but not overpowered. So they have been trying to make this relevant. The cool thing is that the enemy commanders dictate what forces you see on these battlegrounds, and they do act differently. So in one battle, I was up against humans being controlled by Tyrion. Thank you.
Right? Oh, wait, Tyrion's dead, isn't he? Wait.
Lightforged, Draenei.
Tarathion.
Tarathion, thank you.
Or Tyrallion. God, there's so many names that are so familiar. But yeah, no. Yeah, Tyrion's dead. Tyrion's the one that died to Krosis in the original Broken Shore scenario. So Tyrion is gone.
But there we go. But we're talking about one of the original paladins.
Yes.
Tyrallion. Tyrallion leads human forces, and so he leads it in a particular way, and the enemy forces are comprised of one different way. Then you can fight against Moria, right?
And from the dwarves.
Exactly. And so then you'll be dealing with completely different forces. Lady Liadrin has been data mined to be a Horde leader, so she'll be involved with that.
That's probably why she got the new armor.
There you go, yeah. And so there's a lot of variations in it, even week to week, before they open up the next one that'll be maybe later in the expansion with like different world content and everything. And what's really cool about this is that it's old world that we're going to. When we were first doing Legion and there were the initial invasions and everything outside of the Broken Isles, right? I was like, this is great. And then when we did the class quest, they took us to all these places in the old world and everything. And I was like, really loving it. So when 7.2 came around and they're talking about Legion invasions, I was like, oh, are we going to have those go back to like Westfall or the Barons and everything? And then they stayed local to the Legion.
The Broken Isles, yeah.
Yeah. So that felt small to me because the world was under attack, right? And now that the world is engulfed in war, we're going all over the world. We're not just in Zandalar and Kul Tiras. These are flashpoints all over the known world.
Right. So these war fronts, where did they do the testing? Like, did they go to the old zones and then did those old zones get a bit of an upgrade, or is it all just like, because I feel like they were talking about putting a war front in the Plaguelands somewhere, because basically the idea was that Silvermoon was still controlled by the Horde and that was like the last defense on the Eastern Kingdoms or the Horde. And then on the flip side, it was the same with the Exodar as like the final alliance stronghold in Kalimdor, and that was kind of like the two places that they were talking about potentially putting war fronts. So there's more locations than just that.
So right now, like we said last week, there's only the two locations that we know of, right? There is the Southern Barrens and then there is the Arathi Highlands. As they introduce more, yeah, we could have very much that as the story goes along. But when you do the the actual event for the Warfront, you're in an instance area, right? Along with a raid group, and you're pushing forward. When that Warfront is complete, the zone will phase to be Horde controlled or Alliance controlled, whichever one pushed that Warfront and won that Warfront. And that's where the content is supposedly going to be unlocked, if not locked off specifically, because if you remember, actually this is before you were playing, but if if our viewers or listeners remember how Wintergrass worked, is that you would fight over the area, and when it was controlled by your faction, you would have access to rares that would spawn and give you different resources.
There was a dungeon in Wintergrasp as well, wasn't there?
Yes, there was also a it originally started as one boss that would give you tier for that boss, and then there would be different vaults that would unlock, which would contain other bosses as the expansion grew and went further in. So you would control this, you would fight the boss, get your loot, right? And that wouldn't be available to the other faction. Meanwhile, if they went into the zone, they would be dismounted from flying, right? And then they wouldn't be able to even see certain resources. It would be completely blocked off to them. And I think this is going to be a similar situation to what we're going to get from Warfronts, where there will be a world boss, but it will only be available to the controlling faction.
Right.
Right.
Very, very cool. The new things that they're putting into, I was about to call it Legion, Battle for Azeroth, I think there seems like there's going to be a lot more ways to play. So I'm really looking forward to getting in there. I want this expansion now. you also tested out the new in-game voice chat, which is in the alpha now. That was with last week's patch, right? Not this most recent one, but it is now available to use. What did you think?
So it's a good tool. It's very easy to use. What will happen is that you'll join a group and a little toast will come up prompting you, do you want to accept and join the voice chat, right? Beyond that, you're already in. You don't have to set up anything. And the default key is the tilde so that you can press to talk. There is no open mics, thank goodness.
Yeah.
But it is what the community is. I was testing this the first time. I actually had somebody in. Was actually the third time I joined a group. So I tested this when I was doing the original Uller testing. Nobody was in the group. We actually joined TeamSpeak, right? I tested this again, and the third time I tested it, and one other person joined in, and they decided to bless me with so much profanity that I just left. And that's...
This is my problem with voice chat, and we obviously didn't talk about it on this show, but I think I have spoken about it before, possibly on Gamers In, when Heroes of the Storm brought group voice chat into their game, and it's a little bit different, I feel like, in at least the PvE aspects of World of Warcraft, but my issue in Heroes of the Storm is it becomes a competitive expectation that when you join a group, you will join the voice chat. Which is fine if you have a, I don't want to say normal sounding voice, but there are certain characteristics of a voice, like if you sound female, if you sound young, if you sound old, there are things that people are going, even accents, things that people can like grab onto to use as like to use against you, I guess, basically. Like, I don't want people to know that I'm a girl. And this always worries me, and it's probably okay in PvE content. I'm sure there's probably, once it goes on live, it will become the expectation that you join this, just because voice communication is a lot easier than trying to use your entire keyboard to be playing World of Warcraft and then also typing out messages at the same time. I know lots of people more talented than me can do both, but I can't. I cannot type in raid chat while I'm trying to execute my rotation. Can't do it. So I like this kind of thing does worry me a little bit for PvP specifically, because I feel like if I join a battleground, like PvP is already known as more toxic than PvE, even though like LFR can be terrible sometimes. But battlegrounds, the times when people aren't yelling at each other in battlegrounds are few and far between. So once you give those people voice chat, I'm really worried about this.
Yeah, it is a product of whatever community you're doing this with. I had a good experience where I was jumping into a dungeon. This popped in and we were five random people in TeamSpeak going through a dungeon being like, how does this work? And oh, okay, that's a shield. Pull them out of it. So we were able to handle situations and adjust to it much faster than if we were typing or just completely waiting till the wipe had happened to then go, okay, let's dissect this. So it's a tool and it can be used well and it can be used poorly. They have options in there so that when somebody maybe says something completely disgraceful or just something you just don't agree with, you can mute them independently, or you can deafen the entire channel with a single click, right? You can also mute your own mic with a single click. You don't have to go through options for that. They have basically put the general options for just you right there beside the chat window. On live right now, they're just scroll button, so you can scroll up or down. That's now been moved to the right side of the chat window. You can just see the mic and the sound on the left side, and you go, okay, you know what? I don't want to hear this noise anymore. Mute everybody. Or you can mute yourself. Mm-hmm. So luckily, those options are there and fairly seamless. I just know that it is going to be
It's going to be hit experience. And miss. Yeah, it's going to be hit and miss depending on if you can actually make use of this feature. And you're right. It's really going to depend on the community and the group that you end up in. You never know. Maybe I don't know. I kind of wish that this feature came along with another kind of tool, or maybe there are already tools in game to kind of like flag players at, like, I know you can ignore players, but can you actually say, like, don't match me up with this player again? Is that a feature in WoW? Because if that was all tied into voice chat, so it was like an easy click button that I could be just like, this guy's really toxic, report / don't pair me up with him again, like, because then eventually it could be a great tool because you've kind of curated your experience and you've weeded out all of the people that you don't want to hear from and you don't want to group up with. So is that actually a feature? I mean, like, because again, I have not done a whole lot of grouping with people in World of Warcraft outside of my friends. I tend to stay away from it because of my fear of harassment and toxicity. And I do this across all games. This isn't just World of Warcraft. So I'm not 100% aware of all the tools that are available, but I would hope it was easily clickable from the voice chat interface.
Reporting. They have updated it so that you can report for voice communications particularly. I do not know if they are recording it so that they can go through and see how bad that infraction is and respond accordingly. I hope that they just put a big disclaimer being like, you are going to be recorded. If you do this, it will violate the terms of service, and they update the entire terms of service and everything. I think that if somebody is on your block list or ignore list on live right now, you are heavily favored not to team up with them in any kind of random group finder thing. So I have been lucky / blessed to only have about two or three people on my ignore list. Zero since I switched servers, because I know what the battle groups are, and so like I don't have a chance of running into those people. I think it is telling of a community, right? When you have to build things like that. I know we're gonna have a conversation soon about communities and I'll go into it further, but there are steps that Blizzard can do and there are steps that you can do to make the game just seamlessly better for yourself.
Yeah, kind of curate your experience a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. We will, we're a little bit pressed for time this week, so we'll probably talk about that next week. But one more small piece of news here is you can now gift your Blizzard balance, so your Battle.net balance, you can gift to your friends, which is, I think, great. It's kind of a long time coming. I was always curious because we run the other show I do, Angry Chicken, we run Hearthstone tournaments, and it was always such a pain in the ass to actually give people their prizes for winning the tournament. We would we'd have to go out and buy actual plastic gift cards, scratch the stuff off the back to get the code, and then email the code over to our winners. And just the whole process was just such a pain. And then they added gifting of packs. So that's what we've done for our most recent tournament, is we've just gone in and gifted people a certain number of packs. But this is going to be great because now we can just add money. And I know this is obviously a very like niche case where, you know, we're running tournaments and we're giving things to other people all the time, but we'll be able to just go and say like, okay, our prize pool for this tournament is $150. I can just add $150 to my Battle.net balance and then disperse it at the end of the tournament. So this is like huge news for us, and I love that this is now a possibility that you can just send money through Blizzard. I think it's great.
Yeah, no, like, and even on a smaller thing, like I had a friend that I have been playing with for years when I came back to the game, and I was like, you know what, I want to give something because I know it's her birthday, right? And so I had to get her account information so that I could buy her the expansion, right? And it's like, that's a huge level of trust that I wouldn't give to all my friends, right? Now I could just gift balance. And they have done a good job on like restricting how this works so that you don't get like your account hacked and suddenly you're giving like Mets and money to like everybody. They can only be the recipient can only get a balance donated to them or given to them if they've been your friend for at least 7 days. So if your account gets hacked, get it sorted out before.
Yeah, you have time to deal with the hacking before your balance is at risk.
Exactly.
Not that I really carry a Battle.net balance anyways. I mean, there are so many Blizzard things I want that money just does not stay in that balance. But still, if you are someone who has a Battle.net balance, then that would definitely be a concern.
Definitely. And then how it works is that you go through the shop on the website, the Blizzard shop, or through the launcher, and you can then get the purchase, send that to your friend that qualifies, right? And they get it in their launcher. There is an email that goes out, but the email is only a reminder, right? They have to claim it through the launcher. And this is also smart because I can see people being like, hey, you've received Blizzard bucks. Sign in here.
Click
with
here,
those phishing emails.
So yeah, again, you're right. It's keeping it out of the email system and keeping it locked down in the launcher, where most people, and guys, if you have not done this, run and do it right now. Put an authenticator on your account. Do that two-factor, like lock down your Blizzard account. And then so if you do, then you are safer doing things just straight through the launcher. So yeah, if you haven't put an authenticator on your account, shame on you. It's super, super easy now. You used to have to get like actual physical like keychains, and now it's just an app on your phone. So get the authenticator, easy peasy. I've also done really dumb things, like gotten a new phone and totally wiped the old one, given it to like wherever I bought my new phone, and then I get home and I'm like, my authenticator. And Blizzard is super, super good about their customer service when it comes to authenticating accounts and things, and there's lots of different ways that you can prove that you're you, and they'll open up your account again. So you just have to, it's really, really easy. And if you're worried that you're going to lock yourself out by doing stupid things like I do, then don't worry, because you can actually prove that you're you by like sending them your passport or your driver's license photo and stuff. And they're really good about unlocking your things really, really quickly. So go get yourself an authenticator and be safe in the launcher.
And you're not alone. Like, it's happened. At one point, I actually switched phones and I had to get my authenticator removed. So I called in. I luckily kept my authentication information down.
Oh,
so I just gave her the password.
Every time I get a new phone, this happens to me. I have to send them my driver's license, and I'm like, it's me again.
But again, you're not alone, because when I gave him the code, she's like, oh my God, you have that? Because nobody ever does that, right? So again, and once you get that authenticator, take that code, put it someplace safe, right? So that you can just skip having to send your passport in and everything. Just be like, okay, listen, I got a new phone. Here's the old authenticator info. Please remove that, and I'm going to put a new one. And they'll be like, thank you. It'll be a real quick phone call or like online talk. Yeah. Right? And it's done. But it makes your account so much more secure.
The first time I did it, I had totally forgotten to get the old authenticator code, and that was, you know, on me. But I've changed phones 3 more times since that happened. And every single time when I first do the authenticator thing, I take a screenshot of all the authenticator information, which probably gets deleted when I then go and get a new phone. So I'm like, I know I remembered to like make note of this, but the way that I made note of it, it just now it's gone. So it's either gone or it's so buried in the like thousands of photos and screenshots on my phone that like I can never find it again. So yeah, total tangent there about authenticators, but everyone should go authenticate their account. That brings us to our lore section today. Like I mentioned, we are talking about Lady Liadrin. I am very, very excited about this character. I think she's super cool. And like we mentioned, she got updated armor in the alpha. She's going to be one of our war commanders. So if you are not familiar with Lady Liadrin, because I feel like the majority of her story has been told through either the Blood Elves or the Paladins, and also a lot of novels. She's in, I believe, 4, if not 5, Warcraft novels. So there's a very good chance that you're not familiar with this character. So since she's going to be leading the Horde effort in the Warfront, you're going to be either, you know, fighting with her or fighting against her. We wanted to cover her today. So Liadrin's story starts when her parents were actually killed during the Troll Wars by the Imani Trolls. If you guys remember back to our Zandalari conversation, the Troll Wars were approximately, I want to say, 2,500 years before the Dark Portal. So the thing about elves, they live a real long time. So this is where Liadrin's story starts. Without her family to raise her, she was actually taken in by High Priest Vandalore. Years later, Liadrin, under his tutelage, had become a High Priestess and heard rumors of a plague that had hit Lordaeron. Her belief that the Elven Kingdom of Quel'Thalas had been right to distance themselves from the humans was strengthened by the news. The Quel'Thalas would not enjoy peace and safety much longer. And you guys know where this is going. Prince Arthas then marched on from Lordaeron to Quel'Thalas and destroyed everything in his way. Lady Liadrin was actually present at the battle behind the walls of Silvermoon when he attacked, and as a priestess, she was attempting to heal everyone that she could, but she was very disheartened because, as we know, Prince Arthas had killed the Ranger General Sylvanas and was essentially parading her around the city and telling everyone who was present in Silvermoon attempting to defend that they basically had a choice. They could either surrender and serve or die. That was essentially the choice that had been presented to them. And so they chose to, well, they chose to defend, which by extension was kind of choosing to die. And Liadrin was having all kinds of problems calling upon the light. She and the other elves were unable to stop Arthas, and so had to retreat back to the island of Quel'Danas to protect King Anastarion, who was the king of the Blood Elves at the time. This is Prince Kael'thas's father. And so they fell back to attempt to protect him and the Sunwell.
And so at this time, they weren't exactly Blood Elves. They were the High Elves.
Yes, sorry. And I'm using Blood Elves, but yes, you're right. They are, at this point, they're still the High Elves.
Exactly. So when Liadrin reached Quel'Danas, she discovered her friend Darkan had betrayed his people in favor of the Scourge. Not even the ocean stopped Arthas as he froze the water as he walked his way over to the Sunwell. Grand Magister Bellovir, commander of the Elven armies after the fall of Sylvanas, battled Arthas and his Scourge, but was overrun and cast aside, gravely wounded. Liadrin and her companion, Veldalor, attempted to heal Bellovir while the king fought the battle with Arthas that he could not win. Liadrin tried to heal her king, but the light failed her.
I love watching, and I mean, I'm bad at pronouncing things too, but you guys, watching Manny try to get all these elven names out is so fun.
Oh, many apostrophes.
I know. So as the Scourge overran the island, the mortally wounded Bellavere teleported Leadrin away with his final action, ensuring she was safe when the Sunwell became tainted by the resurrection of Kel'Thuzad. With that, Arthas's mission was complete. So he killed the traitor Darkon and left Quel'Thalas. Overcome with guilt and failure, Leadrin refused to call upon the light as it had forsaken her in her hour of need. Prince Kael'thas prepared the remaining elven forces for an attack on the Sunwell to kill the Scourge on the island and destroy the corrupted Sunwell. Leadrin went to her old friend Lothamar, which, if you guys are familiar, he is the current leader of the Blood Elves, and asked to accompany them, but not as a priestess, as a warrior. Prince Kael'thas was successful, and the Sunwell was destroyed, and the High Elves were reborn that day as the Blood Elves.
Yes, and so now we move into the formation of the Blood Elves. 5 years later, Leadrin was overcome with the guilt of her failures to heal with the light when the Scourge attacked, and for not dying like so many of her friends and allies. She retreated from Blood Elven society, hunting the Scourge in the Ghostlands, looking for Darkon. And so Leadrin was very wary of their prince alliance with Illidan. As the as he embraced fell magic and taught the Blood Elves how to feed their arcane addiction, which was a side effect from the destruction of the Sunwell. By forcibly siphoning mana from creatures, they were able to stave off the addiction, but it still consumed their society. This type of magic had been corrupting Blood Elf society, and it turned most Blood Elves' eyes green, including her own. She was then summoned by the regent, and Leadrin returned to Silvermoon for the first time since the attack, and was surprised to find it almost completely reclaimed. Reunited with Lothamir, she received an offer from the new Grand Magister, Roma.
So Ramoth told Leadrin that the prince had subdued a Naru named Muru, who had been sent to Quel'Thalas as a source of magic to be siphoned by the Blood Elves. The Grand Magister had different plans from his prince, though. Using Leadrin, a once powerful priestess of the light, he channeled the power of the Naru through her, infusing her with a light that could never again ignore her call. She became the first ever Blood Knight, who was an elven paladin. Leadrin became the matriarch of the Blood Knight Order and served Silvermoon ceaselessly, but the Order was very controversial with many of the Blood Elves because of the method that they used to obtain their power. So not everyone in Blood Elf society was kind of on board with enslaving and siphoning this godlike entity. Leadrin's old apprentice Galel returned, asking for a place among her Blood Knights as he too had been abandoned by the Light. And I find this really interesting because throughout, like, all the novels and everything, they don't really talk about why the Light abandoned the elves in the defense of Quel'Thalas, but it definitely wasn't something that was unique to Leadrin. I think that there was, like, this kind of conflict and the loss of Silvermoon was something that they had trouble kind of processing and dealing with in the heat of battle. Not that they never expected to lose, but they had never been through something like that, so I feel like the connection to the light was more on each of their individual sides, but it's still really interesting that the reason why the light abandoned the elves at this, like, crucial moment is never really explained in any way, shape, or form. So, but we do get confirmation through Galel that the abandonment of the light was not unique to Lady Leadrin. So Leadrin agreed and allowed him into the Blood Knights, but warned him that the path was not going to be an easy one and he would be tested. The Blood Knights were sent to Drakon's former residence. And so Drakon was killed by Arthas, but then raised as a member of the Scourge. So there was an increase of Scourge activity around his former residence. And this was because the Lich King, Arthas at this time, had heard of the formation of the Blood Knights and wished to enslave them to serve the Scourge.
So Drakon, now a leech, laid a trap for them, using Galel as a scapegoat for a murder he did not commit. Galel fled while Lothamir and the other Blood Knights dealt with Drakon. Leadrin pursued Galel. Unable to control his addiction and the voices in his head caused by the infusion of Maru's power, Galel had indeed gone mad, forcing Leijin to kill him and causing her to question if she was really on the right path. Leijin returned to Silvermoon to hear that the Blood Elves had been accepted into the ranks of the Horde. She remained in the capital to train new Blood Elves and oversaw the fight against the Scourge in the Ghostlands and the Plaguelands.
So just as Blood Elven society seemed to be recovering and they found their place in the Horde, her order began to gain influence and acceptance. But then Prince Kael'thas sold his allegiance to the Burning Legion and stole Maru from Silvermoon. So without the source of their power, Leijin became desperate and traveled through the dark portal to Shattrath City to meet with Adal, another Naru. So you can tell how desperate she was. She's literally been enslaving and siphoning a Naru, and she decides to not only go to a different world, but also approach the very race who she's been exploiting for years. So Adal actually told Leijin essentially not to fear, because Maru had foreseen his fate long ago, and he allowed himself to be captured and used by the Blood Knights in order to be the catalyst for their eventual redemption. So inspired by the knowledge that Adal had given her, Leijin renounced her ties to House Sunstrider and returned to fight Kael'thas on Kel'Danas alongside the Shattered Sun Offensive. After the defeat of Kael'thas and Kil'jaeden, Leijin returned to the Sunwell alongside Prophet Velen of the Draenei. Velen channeled the heart of Maru into the Sunwell and restored it to its former power, removing the need for the elves to siphon mana from other creatures. And this is actually interesting because Blood Elves used to have a racial ability that they had to use, that they would actually siphon mana from creatures around them. And that was part of like the actual gameplay until patch 3.something, when it was removed. And the reason it was removed was lore reasons, because they no longer needed to do that because of the restoration of the Sunwell. So I find that kind of a cool little aside. So through Maru's sacrifice and Velen's kindness, Leijin's faith in the light was restored. And she vowed to use her newfound freedom to restore the Sindori to their former glory while training new paladins to serve the light, not twist it.
And that leads us to the Burning Legion. So when the Iron Horde invaded Azeroth, Leijin and her paladins went through the dark portal to Draenor, surviving in Tanan Jungle and ending up in Frostbriar Ridge along with the rest of the Horde. Leijin and her Blood Knights were dispatched to Akhen Dûn to assist Exarch Maladar in defending one of their most sacred sites from the Legion. Once Akhen Dûn was secure, Leijin began searching for a way to cure the fell orcs Gul'dan had created when he took over the leadership of the Iron Horde. Ultimately, Gul'dan was unsuccessful and fled to Azeroth to begin the invasion, leading to the death of War Chief Vul'jin. Leijin had traveled back with the rest of the Horde to be present for his funeral and to see Sylvanas rise to War Chief. Leijin was then called to Dalaran to convene with the other paladin leaders and pledges her aid to the reformed Knights of the Silver Hand and their new High Lord, the Player.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like whenever you see like High Lords and Death Lords and all that, it's because once we get into actual Legion content, we no longer have named characters for these because they're the player characters, which was a decision they made. I don't think it was a good one, but that's the way this expansion played out.
So her arrival was fortunate because shortly after, the Sanctum was attacked by the Knights of the Ebon Blade, who had come to claim the body of Tyrion Fordring, who, if you remember, died at the Broken Shore. Leijin was the last line of defense against the Order, and though she was defeated, the Light interceded on her behalf, killing Darian Morgraine and causing the retreat of the Death Lord and his horsemen.
Take that, Death Knights!
Leijin then learned that Light's heart, entrusted to the new High Lord, had been taken to Prophet Velen. She and the High Lord arrived at the Exodor to find it under attack, and with the help of Velen, defended his people. Velen was pleased to see her and how far she had come in service of the Light. After returning to the Broken Isles, Leijin and her Blood Knights traveled to Surmar to help the Nightborn reclaim their city from the Burning Legion. Legion discovered a kinship with the Nightfallen due to her experience with both addiction and a leader's betrayal. Together, they formed a tentative alliance with Tyrande Tyrande Whisperwind and charged into Suramar. The combined elven armies breached the city, but were stopped when confronted by Elisande.
Liadrin and the Blood Knights are singled out by Elisande specifically because she believes that Liadrin and her people, above all other elves, should be sympathetic and understanding of the choice she had to make to save her people. And this is, I loved seeing this in the game because it kind of was a callback to Arthas. So basically what happened to the Nightborn likely would have happened to the Blood Elves had they stood down and served Arthas instead of fighting and to the last and being destroyed. So I loved this kind of callback to say, like, look, we were faced with the same decision and we both have an addiction to our source of power in the Sunwell and the Nightwell. Your story is the same as ours. You just made a different choice and your people were destroyed. I didn't want that to happen to my people, so I chose to serve the Legion instead. And I thought that that was a really interesting callback and a really interesting conversation when Liadrin and Elisande came face to face. So Elisande trapped the entire army in stasis and leaves to go back to the Nighthold. Though Khadgar is able to free Liadrin and Tyrande, the rest of the forces are stuck and the battle was lost. Liadrin then accompanied Khadgar, Thelristra, and a group of warriors, which is the players. This is where we go to raid the Nighthold. So the assault on the Nighthold began from below, and when the battle for the Nighthold was over, and Thelristra was given the choice to either restore the Nightwell or destroy it, Liadrin is by her side and was very impressed that Thelristra chose the latter and allowed her people to carve out a future away from the allure of its power. When Velen finally sounded the call of war to depart for Argus, Liadrin was head of the Horde forces against the Burning Legion. With the fall of the Titan Argus, Sargeras was defeated and her lifelong crusade against the Legion came to an end.
And so Liadrin remained close with the Nightborn of Suramar following Thriasa's return to power. Liadrin suggested that the Nightborn become a potential strong ally when the Warchief was summoning the Horde leaders to recruit new members. And Sylvanas, intrigued by Suramar's resources, approved of this choice. Liadrin then left for Thrissa's estate, bearing an invitation to Silvermoon, and reunited with the First Arcanus. Thrissa, who weighed the respect and compassion Liadrin and her people had shown the Nightborn against Tyrande's hostility and only grudging support, was already receptive to joining the Horde. Liadrin traveled with Thrissa to Quel'Thalas, introducing her to her old friend Lorthamir, Regent Lord of Quel'Thalas.
I did find, so this is kind of the story, like Liadrin is very central to the storyline of bringing the Nightborn into the Horde as an allied race. And I did find this very interesting because we don't actually get to see, as members of the Horde, we don't get to see any of Tyrande's interactions with the Nightborn. But when we do play through this storyline, the conversation with Thelristra about Tyrande is a little jarring. And this is coming from, like, I don't like Tyrande. I don't particularly like the Night Elves and the Alliance. So, but even then, it seemed to kind of come out of nowhere. But yeah, Tyrande was really hostile towards Thelristra and was basically just like, you're a means to my end fighting the Legion. I don't like you or your people. And it was pretty brutal in some of the things that Tyrande said. And it seemed very out of character, even when I don't have a very positive view of Tyrande's character anyways.
Yeah, like Tyrande is a strange character because she is the leader of her people when Malfurion and the Druids were off hibernating. Mm-hmm. And they have, as they've brought her more into the story, she's being very rough around the edges. In like Mists of Pandaria, there is an entire scenario where they are redeeming Varian because he started off as a war hawk and wanting to crush the Horde and then became softer, more of a central High King leader, right? And the entire scenario revolves around him being like, no, patience, Tyrande. We're going to do this the right way. And it seems odd because Tyrande's got thousands of years on him and the elves are all about the long game. So to have her as such a brash and rough around the edges leader seemed odd to me. But this is a continuation of it, because when you go into Legion, and people who know how Taronda acted in the Legion Alpha or Beta versus how they went on live, she was actually meaner to the Horde players that were helping her, and then they had to dial it down a bit. So they have a very brash, rough look at Taronda, and that sort of follows what was shown here. So I wasn't as shocked as you seem to be, but it does seem contrary to like how I would have depicted Taronda.
Yeah, and especially for me as someone who played through, like, I don't have that much of a background with Taronda. I didn't play the alpha beta stuff for going into Legion. Mostly what I have of her character comes from a lot of the books, because again, I don't play on the Alliance side, so, and I haven't had that many interactions with her as a Horde player. So mostly what I get is from the books, where she seems to be very soft and kind, and like you would expect a 10,000-year-old elf to be, you know, very, very thoughtful, very slow, very calm. And so to me, it was like seeing her in both Valshara and also then through Thalrissa's visions, the only real interaction I had had with her as a Horde player had been through the Insurrection campaign and doing those 12 weeks of assaulting Suramar City and leading up to the confrontation with Elisande. And she wasn't necessarily friendly, but she wasn't unfriendly. And then, and especially when I kind of attributed that to me being a part of the Horde and her just being naturally distrustful because of all the history between the Alliance and the Horde, it just seemed very odd to me that she would apply some sort of bias to people who were essentially her people. The Nightborn, the elves in Suramar, were from the exact same society that Taronda grew up in. And the only reason that they were separated is because, like, Suramar was the kind of knowledge center of the Night Elven Kingdom. It was a separate city from where the Well of Eternity ended up exploding. But they were all part of the same society. And it was very interesting to me that Taronda just had no time for Thalrissa and the Night Fallen or the Nightborn, either or. And it was just, it was really surprising to me to see those visions of the conversations that Thalrissa showed Liadrin. So, I mean, they had to separate, because I also feel like the Void Elves and everything that happens to Illyria, which we're going to talk about in a second, I feel like that was very heavy-handed in the other way. And I know that they had to put the allied races on either side to balance the game and everything else. But I feel like a lot of the divisions that were created felt very quick and artificial. And it was a little bit jarring for me as a player to see some of the things that happened. So when it really went off on a total tangent and aside there, sorry, well, guys.
No, it's a cool tangent. I do want to say, though, that like her bias towards the Nightborn is very founded, right? When you look at her story, she rebelled against that society. She was the rebel fighters against the queen.
Against the queen, and Suramar was separate.
Suramar was siding with the queen until they were like, wait a second, she's going too far. And instead of joining the fight to help, they decided to isolate themselves and leave the rest of the world to its own devices.
Yeah.
So, I can see that resentment. It's really just they are like the arcane channeling elves that like led to the disaster.
The Highborn. Yeah.
Right. So like it's a time bubble for her, and all of that she may have repressed, like it's just opening up old wounds. So I can sort of see it. It's just that she's being a very poorly characterized player in the World of Warcraft.
Fair enough. So to get back to Liadrin's story. So where we left off is Liadrin and Thalrissa traveling to Quel'Thalas and being introduced to Lorthamar, who is now the head of the Blood Elves. So Liadrin, Lorthamar, Ramoth, who, if you remember, helped found the Blood Knights, and Illyria, who we talked about is Sylvanas' sister, and all of the Nightborn who came with Thalrissa, then departed to see the Sunwell, because obviously the Nightborn were very, very interested in the Sunwell. They had had their own Nightwell, which was their version of the Sunwell. So they wanted to see what the Sunwell was all about, as well as Illyria. For Blood Elves, going to see the Sunwell is very much like a pilgrimage. So that's why Illyria was accompanying them. Liadrin confirmed to Illyria that the energies of the Sunwell had been changed since its destruction and restoration, because, as we mentioned, the Heart of Muru was used to cleanse and restore the Sunwell. And so now the Blood Elves were sustained by the light as opposed to the arcane. So when Illyria, who had consumed the void on Argus, stepped near the well, corruption erupted and the void beast poured into the chamber, seeking to claim the power of the Sunwell. Liadrin and the others fought off the void agents as well as a void monstrosity long enough for Ramoth, Illyria, and Thelrissa to close the void rift before the well was lost. In the battle's aftermath, Thelrissa pledged Suramar to the Horde and accompanied Liadrin back to Orgrimmar to meet with Sylvanas. So this is what I was talking about with the kind of heavy-fisted, because at this point, this is when Illyria is banned from the Horde and banned from Quel'Thalas and told she's no longer a child of the Sunwell and everything else, and which I think was very, none of this was her fault, but I'm not going to go into a big Illyria tangent and why can't I play fun-haired Void Elves, but this is where we kind of leave Liadrin off as back in Orgrimmar, bringing the Nightborn into the Horde and being very important to maintaining that relationship. So she's now in Orgrimmar, heading into Battle for Azeroth, and as Manny mentioned earlier, we're going to see her as one of our leaders during the Warfront campaign, and I'm sure she's going to pop up in many other ways in the Battle for Azeroth story, so I'm looking forward to that. That brings us to our Community Resources Center section, and today we are wrapping up our look at Auction House add-ons with my personal favorite, the one that I've used the most. I've used this one for years, is called Auctioneer. It's made up of four different tools. There's Auctioneer itself, there's Bean Counter, Enchantrix, and Informant, and they all work kind of in conjunction with each other. So before I just go and talk for like the next 10 minutes, Manny, did you get a chance to check out Auctioneer?
I was looking at some videos. I have been pouring into different add-ons just to sort of get a look at the things. This one, I have videos on the live. I'm currently using TSM. So right. I haven't used this myself, so I'm going to rely on you to show me how this works.
That's totally fine. I feel like these, at least like last week we talked about Auctionator, which was very simple and pared down and made the auction house a little bit easier to use. But I feel like the two big ones are Trade Skill Master, TSM, which we talked about first, and Auctioneer. And I think you kind of fall in either one camp or the other, because they're definitely not meant to work together. Like, you use either Trade Skill Master or Auctioneer. And for me, the reason that I use Auctioneer is I find its UI is a lot easier for me to understand. It's a less powerful tool, I think, than Trade Skill Master. But when I say less powerful, that's more because it requires a little bit more of the player. You need to go on and manually scan the auction house. It doesn't have the automated scanner desktop app that Tradeskill Master has. So you need to actually make sure that you're logging in and scanning the auction house often to get the most out of Auctioneer. But basically what Auctioneer does is it adds four tabs to your auction house interface, as well as actually modifies the first tab of the generic auction house, which is your browse tab. And it adds a percent market value tab and a compacted item view. So you can actually view more in a page. When I was like turning off all of the different add-ons and trying the different things of the auction house, I had forgotten what the browse tab looked like. And I'm like, I can only see like five things at once. This is terrible. Who designed this? Because I'm so used to this like teeny tiny little script in Auctioneer, this like one line thing. It's very, very compact. And it adds, like I said, the percentage market value tab. Column. That's kind of the key to Auctioneer and a lot of its functionality. And because that market value, it doesn't pull from like a greater Auctioneer database. That market value is based on the scans that you have done as a character. So again, this is where like you're going to get more out of it and you're going to get more accurate numbers the more often you're going in and manually scanning, as opposed to Trade Skill Master, where you need to you don't need to do anything. You can just leave the desktop app running and it's constantly getting that auction house information. I'm literally like, I still have the TSM desktop thing running and I'm getting notifications every like 2 hours. Be like, boom, new prices, boom, new prices. I'm like, thank you. So your numbers in Trade Skill Master, because it is automated outside of the game, are probably going to be a little bit more accurate. But Appraiser adds so many more like tools that are very intuitive and obvious. Like the UI design, I find, is a lot easier. And it's the barrier to entry is a lot smaller when you're using Auctioneer as opposed to Trade Skill Master. There's not a whole lot to set up. There's a lot of things that are default. And there are a lot of things that you can tweak and change in your settings. But the default settings for a lot of this, I find very, very easy to use. So back to the tabs that it actually adds. Appraiser is the one I use the most often. Basically, what it does is it gives you a list on the left-hand side of everything in your bags that are available for auction. So you can select an item from that list, and then it will actually pull up the list of your last scanned values for that item. So say you want to sell a gem, and you basically would just click on the gem. It'll show you all the auctions for that gem. It'll also give you a little message telling you when that data is from. So, and it updates all the time. So literally, like, you can go in, scan the auction house, go into your appraiser, and it'll say data from 3 minutes ago. And that will constantly update, so you know the age of the data you're working with. You can also refresh the view of that item right from the appraiser, so you don't have to do a full scan. You can just hit the refresh button and it'll give you up-to-date data. So you don't necessarily have to do a full auction scan every time. You also get a breakdown of the number of items that are for sale in a given price range, which is color-coded. And this part of the tool, I find so intuitive and easy to use. It's freaking awesome. Because you're scanning the auction house and getting a percent market value, the whole app or add-on is then color-coded. So it'll show you, like, underneath the name of the gem, say, it'll have, like, a five in blue / two green / three yellow / 15 red. And what that's telling you is that there are five really, really cheap versions of this gem on the auction house. Then there's, like, two that are below market value, three that are about at market value or slightly over, and then however many, I forgot how many I said there were that were super, but they'll be coded in red and they're super expensive. So it gives you a very easy to understand, very quick version of what the auction house looks like for that item, and you without even pulling it over to the appraiser. This is all just in your list that the appraiser pulls from your bags for every single item. It'll tell you at a glance what the actual auction house looks like for those items. So then if, for instance, I see one of my items, like the Lavish Surmar Feast is one that I sell a lot because I make tons for our raid team and we don't use them as much anymore because we're getting really good at not dying. So selling those, if I see like even 50 and they're, it's just red, I can tell that the market for that right now is really hot. People are selling it way above its market value, and that's something I should be selling. Whereas if I see like 100 feasts and the number is blue, I'm like, okay, that's way below market value right now. Maybe what I want to do is actually buy instead of sell. So it's really easy at a glance in the appraiser to tell what you should be doing with a piece of auctionable gear or mats or whatever. It's super, super easy and really user-friendly. Again, I'm going back to like the UI versus TSM. Like, this to me was really much more intuitive. You can post multiple auctions at a time from the appraiser tab. So you can set how big your stacks are, how many stacks of something you want to sell. And then you just push a button and it's like, bam, all your auctions are done. And then it will also prompt you. So say I want stacks of 15 and I have 80, then it'll pop up and say like, oh, hey, you have a stack. You want a stack in 15, but this stack only has five. Then, you know, do you still want us to post it or do you want to hang on to this like incomplete stack? So you can make that decision on the fly. There's also 9 different stat models you can use to choose your pricing. So I tend to just stick to market value, but there are a whole, like I said, there's 9 different ways to look at pricing and to decide based on statistics that are way beyond me. And they're all on the actual add-on page. They're detailed about what they actually do, but there's like standard deviation. There's like time stuff that I don't know. There's all kinds of crazy pricing models you can use. So you can dive into that, but you're pretty safe usually to use just like the undercut feature or the market value feature. So it will automatically fill in the prices depending on what pricing model you choose. And again, the accuracy of that price is going to depend on how often you're scanning the auction house. So the more you scan, the better those, the better those prices are going to be, and the more likely you are to actually be able to sell your item. You can also batch post things, but that does need to be enabled, which is really, really nice, because if you do accidentally click the batch post items button, you could post, like, it basically posts everything. So as opposed to, like I mentioned before, you can give stack size and the number of stacks you want to post, like that can all be tweaked. If you hit batch post, it'll post everything. So if you only want to post like half of your feasts, for example, then, you know, that's a thing you can do. And because you have to enable batch posts, you don't ever make mistakes about what you're going to be like batch posting and putting all into the auction house. The next part, or the next tab that's put into your auction house. So appraiser is like the really big core part of the auctioneer tool. But it also has bean counter, which I find really interesting when I'm actually actively buying and selling every day and looking for deals and trying to like play the auction house game. What bean counter does is it creates like a journal whenever you bid on something, you buy something, you post something, or get your mail. So this used to be a bit of a problem because I used to use the app for my phone. And then when you're selling and when you are getting the gold back in your mail, when you're using the auction house app, obviously an add-on built in World of Warcraft doesn't work on the app on your phone, so you lose that information. But no longer an issue, guys, unfortunately.
So, silver lining.
Yeah, silver lining to the auction house app going away. So, so it does create journal entries. So then it's a searchable interface that you can go into and you can display your activity over the past day, over the past week, past month. You can see like where you're turning a profit, where you weren't turning a profit, and it actually shows you like where you're losing money. So like for me, usually it's like green as I'm selling all my mats, and then there's a big red line for a battle pet purchase. But it does help you keep track of like making sure that you're actually constantly making money in World of Warcraft. It will also it searches all your bids and your posting and your mail, and it gives you a real accurate, it's like accounting software built into your auction house. There is also, like I mentioned, Enchantrix and Informant, which aren't actually tabs on your auction house, but they are tools that are built into your tooltips. So what they'll do is Enchantrix will tell you what you're going to get when you mill, prospect, or disenchant an item, as well as the market value for those mats. So you can have a green sitting in your bag and you can hover over it, and Enchantrix will tell you, this is going to be worth this many arcana, which means that you are going to get this much gold on the auction house. So you don't have to disenchant stuff to get the mats to see the prices. Informant also gives you additional information. So it'll give you buy price, sell price, item level, what quests it could potentially be for, what classes and professions use the item. It gives you all the information you could possibly ever want about a specific piece in your bag. And all of the buy and sell price is pulled, again, from Auctioneer and that auction house database. So that information will update on the fly, and it'll tell you, like, if you sell this one piece, this is what you get per item. If you sell the entire stack, this is what you get for the stack. And then if you sell everything in your bags in your bank, this is how much money it's worth currently on the auction house. So it's a really good way to see what you've got in your bags on the fly and what you could potentially use it for. One other tab that is kind of reminding me a little, I don't use it very often, but it kind of reminded me a little bit about Trade Skill Master, is one of the other tabs in the auction house is actually your search UI. And there's pre-built kind of filters that you can use to search for things to like disenchant, prospect, flip, things that are below market value. There's a resale pre-built search that just searches for everything that is at 50% market value or lower. So basically all of your blue values, it'll search the entire auction house for just things that fit that criteria. So it's a really powerful tool and one that I should use more often, especially as Battle for Azeroth is coming in. I haven't made much use of it, but it is very, very powerful. It also gives you a search that will search the first page and the last page of the auction house. So you get to see the newly posted things right alongside things that are about to expire. So it's a really quick way to see like what's the most dynamic parts of the auction house are first and last. So there's also a search that'll show you everything that's happening on its way out and on its way in. I think that's pretty much it for Auctioneer. Was there any questions or comments or thoughts about Auctioneer now that I've bled for 10 minutes?
No, I like it. I do see where the parallels are with TSM. A lot of it is that it prompts you for things instead of you creating the script at the beginning, and it always follows that script, which allows you to adjust your behavior based on like what you're seeing. So like in that way, taking away the power from the add-on and putting it in the player is actually really cool. I noticed that because it is scans from a character, that means that if you have the scan based on market value, it's market value for your realm. It's not the regional value.
Yes.
And it is as powerful as you use it. The more you use it, the more accurate your scans are going to be, because you could miss an item selling if you don't go a week. But if you are scanning every day, that's incredibly accurate information.
Well, and that's why I'm kind of at the point now where I like Auctioneer for my in-game interface. I think that it is a much more user-friendly. The UI is better. I enjoy Auctioneer in-game. But I think you can actually use it in tangent with the Trade Skill Master Auction House Scanner and market values and website pricing. So I like Auctioneer in-game, and I think I like Trade Skill Master out of game just because it's constantly doing the scanning for me. So I can kind of like look at my item in-game, Auctioneer tells me a market value, and then I can just like tab out, go to Trade Skill Master and be like, okay, how accurate is this? Because like I've missed, I'll be honest, I haven't played the Auction House game a little bit like in the last little while. So I probably missed a good, like I've been scanning maybe once a week, kind of on Tuesdays on raid night, I'll just scan the Auction House. So I've been scanning once a week, where you should be scanning once every like day or two to get the most out of it, because a lot of auctions are going to be 48 hours, right? So basically, if Auctioneer scans and there's an item that's available for 48 hours and then you scan 24 hours later and it's gone, that's a sale. Auctioneer could be like, sold at this price. So it's you're going to get a lot more information the more often you do it. So doing it once a week, my prices aren't going to be that great. So I can use the TSM tools out of game just as a comparison, and I can, you know, better make a decision. Obviously, it's more time consuming, but I think that UI-wise, Auctioneer is a better tool. And it's also, I like the Informant and the Enchantrix stuff that it shows me on the tooltip. So again, as I'm getting things, as I'm playing the game, I can be like, oh, this green is worth hanging on to, this green I should disenchant, you know, this one I should send, place on the auction house, because for whatever reason it's worth 1,000 gold versus the other stuff that's worth 100 gold. So it's very helpful for me when I'm out in the world to have this Informant and Enchantrix functionality. So I think that's why, that and the UI is why I prefer this one. But I also haven't taken all the time to set up Trade Skill Master, so I think it comes down to sort of an to each their own situation. But I think of the three that we covered, Auctioneer and Trade Skill Master are kind of in a league of their own. And I think Auctionator is a good start, but you're going to want to graduate from that fairly quickly, I think, to either Trade Skill Master or Auctioneer.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Really, you're looking at UI that's barely been touched since 2004, and it really does show its age. So using these is almost necessary to like actually put any effort into the auction house. There is a huge upfront investment that you need to put into Trade Skill Master. But when you do, you can do amazing things. I honestly decided that when we were going through this, that I was going to run an experiment. I started up a little bank alt, threw it some bags and 1,000 gold to get it
literally
started.
While we're recording, you're doing all this in the background.
Well, like after we finished recording.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant like literally while I was talking about Auctioneer, you're like, I'm going to do an experiment. I was like, damn, dude, the multitasking though.
No. This was back when we were
right. Okay.
We first covered covering stuff, and I was like, okay, you know what? let me start this up. And yeah, I just ran it. And in like 3 days, I'd made like 100,000 gold. So like, you can really get
wow.
some stuff out of it.
You need to teach me. Like, I feel like your auction house knowledge is just like way up here. And mine's like way down here.
Everybody has to start somewhere. Honestly, I didn't learn to play the auction house until my friend, who no longer plays Raga Cupcake, was like, yeah, yeah, we could corner the ore market. And so we like just started in one place and like mined up ore and then like started to learn how to do that. And I was doing that without add-ons and then learned how to do it with add-ons. And so coming back into it, yeah, I do have a lot of like ingrained knowledge of like, okay, these are kind of behaviors that I want to follow and track. And so like I'm selling things at different times, but once you get the hang of it, it's really a powerful way of like just making that money. And like, yeah, transferring between, it's funny because transferring between servers, there is a very real consideration that I have to make about gold caps because you can't transfer characters with a certain amount of money. So I'll be like, okay, I'm either going to buy a bunch of WoW tokens or I'm going to splurge on these mounts and so forth. So like, that's what I end up doing. I end up going like, okay, buy some tokens, hit the black market auction house, buy this, right? And then jump over to Earthen Ring because that's what the server we're on now. But like, it becomes a fun little game on its own. So I do invite people to like dive into it. And if you have any like add-ons and stuff that you really want to suggest that we haven't covered here, just write in and tell us about it.
Absolutely. And the same goes for if you guys have any questions specifically for Manny, who apparently is the auction house guru, about like any tips or tricks for general auction house and like reading the server, all that kind of stuff. If you guys want to know any more, just please do send us an email. You can send emails to fazpodcast@gmail.com. Unfortunately, we've run out of time this week, so we're not going to get to our email from Babylon Redeemer, but we will cover it next week, I promise. That's going to do it for us this week. Thank you guys so much for listening. You can subscribe to For Azeroth on iTunes or through the RSS feed, which is posted usually when I post the show notes on Twitter. Show notes are currently still at gamersinpodcast.com, but we will be migrating that over very shortly. The other website we're building is almost done. So yeah, just make sure you guys are going to gamersinpodcast.com/Faz. If not, the links are definitely on the main page at gamersinpodcast.com if you're looking for the show notes. Manny, where can folks find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter. That's TrueVillainManny without the E.
Perfect. Is there anything else you'd like to plug this week?
This week, I don't have anything to plug. I do have something that is kind of in the works that I hope to Ooh. Talk about soon. Yeah, I'm pulling a Scott Johnson, an announcement of announcement. But that will be coming up.
Great. You can follow me on Twitter and Twitch. I'm at Joss Plays. You can find links to everything I do over at jossplays.com. I don't think that there's anything really special going on this week. I'm going to attempt to do a Get Nailed. I believe next Wednesday we're going to be there is a currently a Beautyverse, which is the Twitch team that I am a part of, is doing a April challenge, which has to do with using kind of Eastery, pastel-y spring colors and creating different makeup looks. So I'm going to do nails that are going to fall within that challenge. So it'll be really fun. If you guys want to come and join me again, that'll be next Wednesday. Other than that, nothing really crazy going on. So I guess, yeah, we will see you next week and enjoy the alpha. Bye, guys.
Time is money.
Friend.